You're listening to Israel National Radio.
Being alone on Shabbos isn't fun. That's why CUNShabbos.com offers free and safe Jewish hospitality, which helps match guests with host families from Israel, America, and anywhere around the world. It's like Craigslist, Janglo, or J-Date, but for Shabbos meals. It's great for both travelers, singles, or just someone needing a good place for Shabbos. Don't spend Shabbos alone. Visit www.CUNShabbos.com. That's CUNShabbos, S-H-A-B-B-O-S.com.
Hello and welcome to Life Lessons. This is Judy Simon on Israel National Radio. For today's show, I am delighted to introduce you to Stella Frankel, who is a wonderful Jew filled with mitzvot, raising a beautiful family in Neve Daniel with Japanese-American roots. Stella is 43 years old, born in Ithaca, New York, to parents who immigrated to America from Japan. And she has a fascinating journey, which she will share with us today, on how she came from being completely unaffiliated with anybody Jewish to becoming a Torah observant Jew living in Israel. Stella, how are you doing today?
Baruch Hashem, I'm doing well. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you so much for taking time and joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
Stella, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your grandparents. Who were your grandparents?
Well, on my father's side, my grandparents, Tyra and Yoshie, were, of course, born and raised in Japan. And a story that I heard some years ago, when my Japanese was fluent enough so that I could actually have a conversation with them, a decent conversation with them, as opposed to through interpretation from my parents, I found out that my grandfather's family, they were samurais way back when. And when that era ended, they became farmers. So that was an interesting tidbit of family history that I found out.
You come from a fighting family.
Right.
And your mom's side?
And my mother's side, so my father's side, they were more of the country. The country family, so to speak. My mother's family was from the city called Shimonoseki, and an interesting bit of history there. My understanding is during World War II, when the U.S. was figuring out which targets to use the atomic bomb, Shimonoseki, where my family was the original target. It ended up being cloudy that day, and then they switched it to Hiroshima.
Wow.
So, Baruch Hashem, my family was spared of that. And so my mother grew up in a more urban area, and I unfortunately didn't know my grandfather, my mother's father. Well, they divorced, which was very unusual at that time, that generation for divorce. So my grandmother actually raised her three children and was a very independent, tough, strong woman. And I remember my mother, telling me about her, how much she admired what she did, in raising the kids and not depending on her ex-husband at all, and just an amazing woman. My father left Japan when he graduated high school, and he left the family because at the time the economy was terrible in Japan. This was in the early 60s. My grandmother had a sister in California. So he decided to go to California, use California as a base, and he went there to get a job, to make money, and send it home to his family. And after a few years there, he actually went to night school to learn English. His Japanese name is Hiroyuki, and the story is that his English teacher could not pronounce his name, so she gave him the name Rick. So he's always been known as Rick.
Okay.
So he worked during the day, learned English at night, sent money home, and after a few years, he was ready. He was 18 when he went, and around 21, 22, he decided, okay, I'm ready to get married. He went back to Japan, and it was basically a shidduch between my parents. Some relatives on both sides of the family knew of, I think my father's uncle knew my mother's cousin or something like that. And they suggest they meet. My mother was only 18 at the time, and she was just starting college, and she wasn't interested. And my father wanted to marry someone who was willing to go back to the United States with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know, in itself is not really a big sell for, you know, for anyone who really wanted to stay in Japan and not leave, you know, home and family. But my grandmother apparently met my father, was very impressed with him. I guess she saw that he was going places, you know, it was serious and settled and, you know, with purpose and so forth. And she felt that it would be a good match. So she really encouraged my mother to meet him. And so they did. And I don't know how soon afterwards they got married, but they got married. My father then went back to the United States, and for some reason there was a problem with my mother's visa, so they were separated for about a year. She couldn't get into the States. She finally arrived, and this was around Vietnam, the time of Vietnam, and my father was, he wasn't drafted, but he was recruited to go to a training center. They were living in Ithaca, New York at the time where I was born,
mm-hmm.
and my father had to leave and go to a base, I think, in North Carolina, not soon after she arrived. And, you know, it's amazing to me. My father said he, you know, she had very little English. I mean, they, all of them learn English in school. It's part of their education. They can read and write beautifully, but conversational English is very difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
But he helped her get her driver's license there. He found her a job, and then he went off.
Wow.
And he had to, you know, I don't know how many months he was there, and I remember he also wasn't there for my birth because he was at this training base, but he never had to go to Vietnam, thank God. But that was quite a beginning, I remember, for them in their marriage.
And first being apart while she was trying to get a visa, and then as soon as she gets here, they're apart again.
And exactly.
In a way, she was like her mother in that she had to become an independent woman, taking care of, you know, her job and her little baby daughter and everything without her husband.
Exactly. And there's a small Japanese community in Ithaca,
mm-hmm.
and they all, you know, helped my mother out, which was, you know, obviously very, very helpful to her. So, you know, looking back in my own journey, I can see definitely we can relate on many levels, you know, the struggles of coming to a new country and having to, you know, learn the language and acclimating and, you know, building a life for yourself.
Your parents did that.
Exactly. My parents did, for sure.
So you grew up in Ithaca. Tell us about your childhood. What kind of childhood did you have, Stella?
You know, just sort of a typical, you know, American kid in the sense that I ran around on my bicycle, played with, you know, friends and, you know, went to this great elementary school and, you know, celebrated the quote-unquote American holiday, Thanksgiving, and, of course, Christmas and Easter because everyone else did. Nothing overtly culturally Japanese per se. It's because we had that little community of Japanese families, although everyone was like me in the sense that, I mean, the kids that were my generation, born and raised in the United States, you know, we were more culturally American than Japanese.
But you spoke Japanese in the home?
Well, my parents certainly spoke Japanese all the time until I started school, and I just realized that, you know, I don't want to hear it anymore. I'd rather you speak English to me, Mom and Dad, and, you know, outside the home for sure.
It's funny. It reminds me of the Jewish immigrants that came from Eastern Europe who said, please don't speak Yiddish to me anymore. It's just, you know, I want English in the house. Too embarrassing, right?
Right, exactly. And it's a shame. I wish that back then that I had the self-esteem or the self-confidence to be able to embrace both worlds and appreciate it. But when you're growing up and, you know, and a kid and you want to fit in and you don't want to be different,
right?
You know, that sort of takes over. And, of course, now looking back, I regret that I didn't keep up the Japanese, you know, the way that I knew it back.
In your childhood, did you have any exposure to anybody or anything Jewish?
You know, I'm trying to remember in Ithaca. We left Ithaca when I was 9 years old, and there, you know, who knows? There may have been kids in my class who were Jewish, but I don't remember learning anything about Jewish people, history, or anything.
Nothing that made an impression.
No, not until much later when I was 13 or 14. There was a family that moved in, and the last time I remember it was Dauber. And the only thing I knew was, the only reason I knew that they were Jewish was that they didn't celebrate Christmas. And which I thought was, what a shame, you know.
You felt sorry for him.
and then nothing, basically until I went to college and met my husband and other, you know, New York Jews. There were a lot. I went to Colgate University, and where, that's also where my husband went, of course. And there were a lot of Jews from Long Island. One of my roommates, you know, was Jewish, and so I started getting exposed to Judaism from them. I mean, not being religious, so to speak, but just culturally Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very interesting. So that was my first exposure in college, I should say.
So you met your husband, and you were dating him, and you knew he was Jewish.
Right.
Now, did that make any impression one way or the other on you?
No, it didn't. And because it's not as if he imposed his beliefs or anything on me. It was, you know, for me, it was a curiosity. You mm-hmm. know, what do you do? And there was a Seder on campus one year that we went to together, which was very, and it was run by these very lefty liberal Jews who they took it to the extreme, this Freedom Seder. All I remember, they, you know, people running around hitting each other with these scallions, and I was like, what is this? You know, they had some strange twist to it, but I was like, okay, well, fine, whatever. But anyways, I went to his family for a number of years, you know, time that we were dating and we got married, and even after we got married, we would always go to his parents for Seder. You know, if we could, we would go up for Rosh Hashanah and go to their temple, have a nice meal afterwards. And if we couldn't go up, we would find something within Washington, D.C., where we ended up moving to after college.
Now, Stella, when you married your husband, your husband really married out. He married a non-Jewish woman.
He married out. I mean, he never expressed concern about it, and he never said, you know, it would be nice if you, you know, would embrace Judaism or consider converting. He never said anything.
And what about his family?
And his family, all, you know, his parents are wonderful, and they would never, to me certainly, would have said, you know, it would be nice if you would consider, you know, converting. They never made me feel bad that I wasn't Jewish. Never felt that at all.
Very accepting.
Very accepting. And, you know, what's ironic is that his brother also got engaged, actually right before us, to a non-Jew. So both their sons married out. And they got married the year before we did. Now, interestingly, his wife has since converted. She converted, I think, a year or so ago. They are very active in their Reform temple and in raising their kids Jewish. You know, even though they're not, you know, quote-unquote Torah-observant Jews like we are, it's nice that the family has sort of come back and embraced its Judaism. It may be, you know, part of it, I think, is when you start a family, it forces you to examine this, you know, this idea of raising your kids with something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for my brother-in-law, it was the same thing. I mean, my sister-in-law said to him, if you want to raise the kids Jewish, you can do that. You know, for her, she's, you know, raised Christian, and the holidays were celebrated as more of a family thing, not as a religious experience, per se. So she let him do it, and then along the way, you know, she started to embrace it herself. And, you know, my in-laws are very proudly Jewish, but they don't feel they need to express it through keeping Shabbat and Kashrut and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father-in-law has always said, you know, I don't need to do that. I don't need to prove my Jewishness by doing those things, you know, because I know what I am. You know, he feels very strongly that way. I went through conservative conversion first, and I remember him. He thought, oh, this is so extreme, Stella. Why do you have to do that? You know, you don't need this. He thought that was just, I didn't have to go as far as that to express my Jewish identity or so forth. I mean, they were very happy and supportive that I wanted to do this. But the fact that we were starting to become Shomer Shabbat and so they were like, you know, you don't need to do that. That's crazy.
Like you'd gone off the deep end.
Right.
So why don't you go backtrack
sure.
a little bit? You mentioned that you started out by going through a conservative conversion. What was the impetus for you choosing to convert at all if you felt so comfortable
right.
in his family?
It's the whole notion of starting a family and, you know, do we want to raise them with some kind of a religious upbringing. And while I didn't have anything, certainly there was, you know, I wasn't raised with anything like that. And my father, who, you know, he doesn't, I don't know if he believes in a God or not, but, you know, his belief is that you can raise your children as good people, and you don't have to have this, whether you're Christian or Jewish or Hindu or somebody telling you what your values should be or so forth. He felt that you can do that without religion.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he believes in that strongly. So there was no, you know, anything religious, you know, in our home. But I think that for some reason I was searching for that, and I don't know why. I felt that there was something missing, and I was very curious and explored different religions just to check out various services. There's a Catholic Mass, you know, a Methodist service. You know, I went to a Sunday school here and there, and just to see what it was like, and, you know, what is this whole thing about God and believing in something, and it spoke to me, but obviously none of them spoke to me enough that I pursued it further. And then, you know, I met my husband, and the exposure to Judaism, what I saw of it, is family-centered, and, you know, what the prayers that they said of Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur and so forth were, you know, were beautiful, and it was to me very approachable. And, you know, little did I know at the time, I thought, you know, I can convert. If this is what Judaism is with these holidays and nothing more than that, I said, I can do this. I'm very comfortable with that. I mean, little did I know how far I would go with that.
Talk about off the deep end.
Right. Exactly. So
you went through a conservative conversion.
Right. So I learned with a conservative rabbi, a wonderful woman who, you know, as I called her, like this cheerleader for Judaism, just loves, you know, loves being Jewish and loves teaching. And so she, for 1 year, I had these one-on-one lessons with her, and my husband would come along as well. There was so much he didn't know.
Right.
He didn't know what Sukkot was. He had not heard of Simchat Torah. He thought Shabbos and Shabbat were two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot that he lacked himself in his Jewish education. So it was an eye-opening experience for him as well.
Filling in the gaps.
Right, exactly. So then, you know, I went through conservative conversion, and we would drive to our conservative shul, and, you know, it was very lovely, and I was quite happy. I was quite happy doing that. And then my husband, through a trip to Israel and spending, going there for work. He was a lobbyist for AIPAC, and he spent Shabbat with a colleague of his who's Orthodox and just loved it. And he said, you know, these people, they're really normal. You know, the kids have this Where's Waldo book. He had no idea what to expect, you know, what a proper Shabbat was like, and that these, you know, people are quote-unquote, you know, Orthodox. And
it sounds like he was almost more surprised by their normalcy than
right.
by the Shabbat itself.
Right, exactly. He laughs about it with his family now, and the kids there still remember the Shabbat that my husband was there, because one of the kids said, "I think I hear the you know, somebody using the bathtub." You know, this is Shabbat morning. My husband had no idea. He's the day before, you know, Friday afternoon. The hostess says to him, you know, do whatever you need to do to get ready for Shabbat. You know, my husband's like thinking to himself, he just sat in the room, he's like, you know, I don't know, what am I supposed to be doing to get ready for Shabbat? You know, and then the next morning, like he always does, he took a bath, a shower. You know, the kids are like, what's going on? Why is this guy taking a shower on Shabbat morning? So, he really enjoyed the whole experience, and he said that the fact that this is like a normal family, so to speak, so he was just ready to just jump right into it and wanted to become Orthodox and you know, tried to convince me that, you know, we should do it. And I said, no, let's do this slowly. I'm not ready to just jump into this. So when he came back from his trip, I said, okay, let's spend Shabbat in some communities. So, you know, we were living in the suburb of Washington, D.C. at the time, and we spent a Shabbat in three different communities. And yeah, I would ask questions, you know, of you know, of our host. And, you know, you have to understand, this is such a very strange concept to me, to spend, you know, a whole day with a family you don't know and, you know, have meals with them and so forth. And it was an odd experience. And you know, I thought it's wonderful. These people are so warm and welcoming, you know, answering all of my random questions about, you know, being too observant and so forth. But, you know, it was not something that the average person does. You know,
right.
You don't go to a stranger's house and spend 25 hours with them. And I was like, this is really nice. And the fact that we were already keeping kosher in the home and we were keeping Shabbat except for driving to our conservative shul, I thought, you know, this isn't such a huge leap, but I'm not going to take that last step until we're living in an Orthodox community. So, and I think this is all Hashem's plan. We spent Shabbat in Potomac, Maryland, with a woman who hosted us is a realtor, and you know she told us after Shabbat, she said, you know what, there's a townhouse that is in our price range that is, you know, for sale, and we looked at it the next day and we bought it.
That was fast.
It was fast, and we, you know, we moved in. Our neighbors, wonderful family, Baal Tshuva Chabad, and she took me under her wing, taught me how to make cholent and brisket and all, you know, all these, because I, you know, what did I know of these things? And she was wonderful. And we moved in the summer of 97. My daughter was due. We lived in Potomac for maybe a month or two, so we didn't know a lot of people. There are three shuls there. And we decided that so I had my conservative conversion, and then so now I was going to go through an Orthodox one. So we were in touch with the rabbi of the big Orthodox shul. He was away for a good part of the summer. So somebody was said to us, you know, and I'm pregnant with my daughter coming to the end of my pregnancy, you may want to go through the conversion, you know, before she's born. And so we decided, okay, you know, it's probably a good idea. And, you know, it's not as if my Jewish education was going to stop. I was going to continue learning. So we had scheduled a conversion for Sunday, the 17th of August. And my daughter ended up coming on Shabbat. And it was a very funny story. We were, the young Israel was where my husband was going to daven on that Shabbat. And they were going to have throw like a little ufra for him. And it ended up going in labor on Shabbat. And so our very funny neighbor, our Chabad neighbor, went to the shul and said, made an announcement after davening, that, you know, there are people here were expecting an ufruf, but the kala went into labor, so it's not going to be. And there were people who were like, what? They had no idea what was, you know, they didn't know the story. I don't think there had ever been, you know, a remarriage like that, you know, with the conversion and then the woman being pregnant.
That's a lot of simchas in one fell swoop. Very efficient of you. I'm going to stop you there for a minute, Stella. We have to take a break. We'll be back with more of Stella Frankel's story. Stay tuned.
LL's new one-stop shop, booking a vacation to Israel has never been easier. It's simple. The easy-to-use system allows you to book your flight to Israel and customize your travel plans with LL's travel partners in the tourist industry and realize huge savings in the process. And now, for Arut Sheva listeners only, order a flight and hotel in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv through the Arut Sheva site and get a free cell phone with 60 minutes to use absolutely free. Click on the banner on IsraelNationalRadio.com.
Yes, darlings, this is Grandma JJ here in the USA. I just called to wish you blessed holidays and a happy new year. And we're standing with you. So we serve the God, the only God of Israel. Don't give up any more land. God gave you that land. Take care of it and do what you need to do. All the blessings of the Holy One of Israel upon you, the only true God, from Grandma JJ in Gallatin, Tennessee. Love you all.
You're listening to IsraelNationalRadio.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We're in the second half of the show Life Lessons. This is Judy Simon on Israel National Radio. We're interviewing Stella Frankel, who was a Japanese-American who ended up converting to Judaism. And we're in the middle of her story. Now, Stella, you were in the middle of telling us you decided to convert.
So we had to put it off for a few weeks. And so my son and my daughter went to the mikveh with me,
mm-hmm.
and then we got remarried. And it was very beautiful. Part of me, you know, is sort of sad that I didn't have that experience, the real experience of being married, you know, with an Orthodox wedding and the Sheva Brachot and all of that. But, you know, but this was very nice. It was really, the community was terrific, and it was a nice simcha. So, you know, I have to say, once we picked Potomac and the house and moved and settled in, I really felt so at home and comfortable. Like, this is the life I think I was meant to lead. And I couldn't have started in a better place. Potomac, you know, just very warm and embracing, and just felt so comfortable. And this all has been, you know, an amazing, fun, interesting, sometimes difficult journey, you know,
wow.
that I've had. And, you know, and Potomac was a great place to start. And we eventually, after 8 years there, my husband was now starting to feel strongly about making Aliyah.
Hmm.
And so, again, I was like, that is a huge step, and I'm not sure if I'm ready to do that right away. So, and I had never been to Israel. So the two of us went. We spent 2 weeks, and it was an amazing trip. Very close friends of ours who actually live in Neve Daniel now. They were in Potomac on Shlichut. We had two kids at the time. They said, leave the kids with us, go to Israel, you'll spend Shabbat with my family, and, you know, they were things for us, and it was a great trip. And so coming back, I said, you know, yes, I can see in an ideal world why you would want to move to Israel and raise your kids there. I mean, that's the place to be. But I just wasn't ready to do that yet. And after a period of year, a few years went by, and as I realized that my son, you know, is getting older, and Potomac, which has a lot of Balchuvas, also a very, you know, large percentage of the community is Jewish. Not everyone is observant, and, you know, in our little townhouse community, you know, they could see that their neighbors who are Jewish, who are driving on Shabbat and so forth, and, you know, I'm not judgmental about things like that. You know, you do what you want to do, and my kids know they have family that's not observant, and they have family who's not Jewish.
Right.
So, you know, we're very open-minded in that way, but I want to raise my kids to be Torah observant, and I realized it was getting more difficult with these sort of outside influences do that in Potomac, and coupled with that. And then the fact that very close friends of ours were planning to make Aliyah the following year, I decided on my own that, you know, we need to move, and if we're going to make a move, it has to be Israel.
Wow.
So we made that decision. You know, we were talking about it, Rosh Hashanah. It must have been 7 years ago. My husband and I, you know, came to our own conclusion, and we were discussing. He was very surprised. You know, he knew that I was struggling with this. So he was quite surprised when I told him, let's do it. And our families, of course, both of them reacted very well. My parents, being Japanese, are, let's say they hold their emotions in check more. They're
mm-hmm.
more stoic. You know, they're upset in their own way. And, you know, my in-laws, you know, you're going to kill your father. You're going to, you know, how could you do this to us? You know, what are you crazy? You know, they let all their emotions out. It's very funny, the differences in
the reaction
and the reactions.
The reaction was much stronger to your making Aliyah than to your becoming Orthodox.
Right. Oh, for sure. For sure.
You're taking the grandchildren away.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And at the time, my father-in-law had already retired. My mother-in-law was retiring that year. They had made plans to sell their house in New York, rent an apartment near us, and rent an apartment near my brother-in-law and his family in California. And they were going to split the time, going back and forth.
So you ruined their plans.
And we did. I mean, it was so difficult to tell them.
Mm.
And we put off Aliyah for like a year and a half or more so that they would have the time with the kids. But yes, the timing was, you know, was unbelievable. I mean, it was good and it was bad in the sense that now that she was retired, that they could do this. But at the same time, it ruined their plans.
Right.
You know, they had it all figured out, and which is wonderful that they wanted to spend a few months at a time with both sets of families. My parents are, you know, in upstate New York, and they would visit every other month and spend a long weekend. And it was, you know, it was heart-wrenching.
Hmm.
It was really heart-wrenching to have to tell them this. And, you know, and for my in-laws, while it was so hard for them, you know, and emotionally, and it was and up to the point of us leaving, so it's very bittersweet and so forth. But after we came, and of course they would come and visit, and when we finally moved into our house, we were in a rental for 2 years, and when we finally bought and moved into our new home, they separately, my father and my mother-in-law, came to the conclusion that, you know what, we're happy that you're happy, and we can see that you are, that you're comfortable here, you fit in. Actually, my father-in-law was saying this to me. He goes, you know, Stella, you really look like you fit in here, that you're very comfortable here, and like you found your place.
Wow.
You know, and it shocked me, and I was so grateful that he said that, and I said, and I appreciated him saying that, and my mother-in-law sent us an email after that trip and said, you know what, we're really proud of you, proud of what you've, you know, decision that you made, and that you're coming to live here with the Jews, and it was just amazing the turnaround that the both of them had.
Because they saw you were happy.
And they, right. And so they could look past, yes, the emotional heartbreak of being so far from their grandchildren, but we've learned to make the best of it. And, you know, we're so grateful that they are supportive, you know, of our decision. Because we know that there's the stories of families who have broken up, who have, you know, parents have never come to visit, or estranged relationship. I do have that to some extent with my family, but, you know, thankfully not as bad as some stories that I've heard. I mean, my family, they right now have made the conscious decision not to visit in the near future.
So you visit them?
So we visit them once a year in the summer for 1 week. And, you know, my parents, you know, thank God, they do have the financial means and the time. I mean, they do have a business, but they are the owners. And they could come if they wanted to, but they choose not to. They choose instead to fly us over to see them. You know, we get together with them and my brother and his family, and we have a wonderful week together. But we, you know, we avoid the issue of the fact that I'm living here,
right,
with the family, and that it's hard. And so I guess it's a very Japanese way of sort of dealing things. We just sort of sweep it under the rug and not talk about it and not deal with it. My kids have asked them to come visit, and they just give this wishy-washy answer. Well, we'll see. But still, I'm hopeful, and I'll continue to be optimistic that they'll come around and visit one day.
You might think that because he left his family in Japan,
right,
and your mother also left her family in Japan, that maybe they'd be a little bit more understanding of your situation.
You would think so. You would think so. That's right. But I don't know.
Stella, you chose the song Zehaya Beti, This Was My Home, which is a kind of a hip-hop version of a song that was created in the wake of the disengagement from Gush Katif.
Right.
Why did you choose that song?
You know, the song reflects the time that we, you know, when we came on Aliyah in July of 2005, the disengagement happened in August. So obviously that whole year, there was so much going on about the families who were going to be expelled from their homes and their communities. And so it was obviously a on the forefront of our minds as we were coming. And when we arrived, you know, there were so many, you know, demonstrations going on, people from Neve Daniel who were heading over there to protest and so forth, and it just made such a huge impression. I mean, this is what being Jews are about, you know, when there is something to protest about or to get, you know, to take action, you know, to see the community, like, geared up to help these families and to do whatever we could to try to stop it was, you know, it was unbelievable. And, you know, my husband and I made a point of going to the Kotel when they were busing these families from their homes, you know, to the Kotel, and seeing it was just so emotionally upsetting and powerful to see the face of these families just so strong, but at the same time, you know, they were just ripped out of their homes and their lives turned upside down. And it was, I can't even explain to you the range of emotions that I felt, you know, feeling so upset, but at the same time just being awed by their strength, that they would continue. And, you know, this song is the reflection of those times, and it just captures that it isn't just their house, it's our house, it's all of Am Yisrael, and we're all in it together.
It sounds to me like even though they were going through a trauma and you were not going through a trauma, there were some similarities in your experiences in that you're both starting afresh in a new community with a lot of fears and a lot of new things to deal with.
No question.
So I'm going to play the song Ze Haya Beiti, This Was My Home, and this is being performed by Hila Harari and Manny Berger.
Ze Haya Beiti. ששכחנו על מה בשבילי זאת מלחמה בשבילם זאת פרנסה בשבילי זה הבית בשבילם זה סתם עוד קו על מפה בזמן זה נהפך להיות הרבה יותר מסתם אדמה אולי אני לא מסכים אבל מבין בי בעיה הפרחנו את השממה וזה מה שאתם נותנים בחזרה הזיכרונות לא מתו הם עפו דירה גם נתקם על הצליחה לא, מפליק בדמיון על זיכרון מהיום שבו כתבתי את החרוז הראשון רץ על סטופר מפריד בין חלום למציאות באלבום התמונות שנים יפות זיכרונות של ילדות יעצור את הזמן שעון דופק מחוגים זזים קדימה ואני מתרחק אין מקום כמו הבית זה לא עוד משפט מצוץ של הגיבורה בספר
זה היה ביתי
זיכרונות יותר, אני זוכר לילה ראשון, נשיקה ראשונה פרידה שלא תשוב יותר שבה אסר כבחר ומריבה לחזרה, הכל קרה מיוקר כשהרמתי ונפלתי אותך דרך המפתן מתכופף אל הארץ, לוקח חוף אל אדמה זה הבית שלי, זאת הילדות הנשמה בבוקר קמתי ונשמתי את האוויר והאבר בינינו עד היום לבית היה חלק בקשר לא מאמין שזה נגמר, עכשיו הכל הכוח יד ביד נהיה לעד ולהיעלם
זה היה ביתי
That song was Zehaya Beiti. This was my home. And it was referring to the event in Gush Katif where the Jews were removed from their homes and had to start afresh. Stella, you've been on a very long and complicated journey. I was going to say, it seems like whenever life gets boring, you make a major life change.
I can't imagine what could be after this.
I wanted to ask you what lessons you feel you've learned along the journey. What nuggets of wisdom can you take away with you, and particularly something that you think might inspire our listeners?
That's interesting. I have discovered about myself the sense that, you know, I confront, well, it's my partner in life, my wonderful husband, who has been sort of the force, I guess you could say, who's, you know, in a way pushed me along this journey as well. I mean, he's been a big influence. And I've learned, you know, when these challenges come up or questions or life-changing moments come, to just sort of step back and, you know, reflect and take time and do, you know, take it little step by step, because I'm not the kind of person who will just jump in and, you know, and just and go for it. I need to take time and reflect, and I think that's something that I've been doing with each stage, you know, of my journey, and it makes it stick. You know, the whole thing with, you know, moving to Potomac into a religious community, and, you know, was still had my hair uncovered, wearing shorts, you know, this and that, and it was like in a very slow process, you know, learning the halachot and so forth, and slowly changing my, you know, my outward appearance to reflect my internal,
your inward, you know, spiritual journey.
Right. And it stuck. I mean, once I stopped, you know, wearing the pants, that was it. And once I started covering my hair, that was it. You know, I know a number of people who Baal Tshuva, who like jump into it, and it was too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then they either stopped, or, you know, they've taken too many steps back and they're slowly, you know, coming back. But that, you know, that I've learned about myself is that taking that time and reflecting and doing it slowly, and so that, you know, you are fully in and committed is very important.
So you're saying that you ease into each change, take
right.
it slow, and take it to the point where it's not just a phase, but it's something that you're accepting upon yourself for life.
For sure. For sure, yep, you said it exactly right. And, you know, and I hope that my kids will also, you know, take that to heart as well. I think they're starting to understand, you know, what the change that I've made in my life. And, you know, hopefully we'll appreciate it more as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they for sure love being in Israel. You know, they couldn't imagine going back to America and living there and being, you know, they love the fun of visiting, and, you know, it's always an ideal vacation. You know, it's not real life, and
mm-hmm.
they understand that. They understand that what they have in Israel is, for them, is much more meaningful, and, it's, you know, it's not a reflection on the lives of our families in, you know, in America. It's just different. It's different in Israel, no question.
And it's just that they're more suited to Israel.
Yeah.
You know, your story, and also based on the songs that you chose, it just shows me so clearly how it's important to you not just to have converted and become Jewish, but become involved in the Jewish people and one with helping your fellow Jews and making the world a better place and making the world more spiritual and all these things, which are really true Jewish ideals. It's like these things are part of your neshama, are part of your soul.
Thank you. Thank you. I have great role models. No, I really do. You know, everyone in the Beit Daniel, you know, has a story or an experience, or, you know, these are professional people, learned people, you know, from all walks of life, you know, Israeli, Dovrei Anglit, you know, from all over the world, and it, you know, every day is just is inspiring. And when I walk my dog, you know, in the Beit Daniel, and I look out over Gush Etzion, and just it, I try not to take each day for granted. You know, it's a beautiful country, and I'm so grateful and blessed that I'm here, and that for whatever reason Hashem, you know, who's helped me along in this journey, who put me here, you know, I'm here for some reason, and I'm grateful for it.
Wow. Stella, thank you so much for being on the show and for sharing your story with us. And I wish you continued success, and Hashem should just continue to shower you and your family with blessings.
Amen. Thank you so much, Judy.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Life Lessons. This is Judy Simon. You can write to me at Judy, J-U-D-Y, at IsraelNationalRadio.com. And I would love to hear your suggestions on people that I can interview. If you know somebody that has an interesting story or who's been on an interesting journey, please be in touch with me. Send me that person's contact information. And if I do end up interviewing the person that you suggested, then I will send you a free CD or a free poster from Israel National Radio as a gift to you and as a thank you for bringing to my attention some interesting person. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope that each of us open our eyes and notice how many wonderful lessons God has put in our paths, things that we can learn from, and things that can help inspire us and make us into better people. That's it for this week's Life Lessons. Thank you so much for tuning in. And we will see you next week. Have a wonderful week.
Kiddushta, the personal touch, invite everyone to their two exciting stores, one in the heart of Jerusalem and one in Modi'im. Kiddushta, the personal touch, is the epitome of elegant style and service. Sterling silver, artistic glassware, jewelry, talitot, mezuzot, and much more. And also features a full boutique wine department specializing in Israeli wines. And, of course, everything is available online at Judaica4U, Judaica, the numeral 4 and the letter U.com.
First Israel Mortgages. Our mission is to help people obtain the right mortgage, get preferred rates, and realize their dream of owning a home in Israel. Our staff is made of American-born Israelis who understand your needs when structuring a mortgage. At First Israel, your financial security is paramount. Visit us online at firstisrael.co.il. That's firstisrael.co.il.